ब्रह्मविद्य संप्रदाय कर्तृभ्यो वंशर्षभ्यो महद्यो नमो गुरुभ्यः श्रुतिस्मृतिपुराणानामालयं करुणालयं नमामि भगवत्पारं शंकरं लोकशंकरं सदाशिवसमारंभां शंकराचार्यमध्यमां अस्मराचार्यपर्यन्तां वन्दे गुरुपरंपरां शंकरं शंकराचार्यं केशवं वाररायणं सूत्रभाष्यकृतौ वन्दे भगवन्तौ पुनः पुनः सर्ववेदान्तसिद्धान्तगोचरं तमगोचरं गोविन्दं परमानन्दं सद्गुरुं तन्तोऽस्म्यहम्। Very good. Welcome back. Good to see you all. We continue with our study of Viveka Chudamani. Remember, we're going through a series of seven questions. First question was with regard to anatma. That question has been answered. Second question was, what is atma? That question has been... Actually, we come to the last. One more verse on atma, which is verse 135. So we'll pick up the thread there. This is actually a very profound verse, a little long, but it says a lot in these four lines. Let's see. Prakriti vikriti bhinnaha, prakriti vikriti Shuddha Bhoda Svabhavaha, Shuddha Bhoda Sarasaridamashesham, Sarasar Bhasayan Nirvisheshaha, Bhasayan Nirvisheshaha, Vilasati Paramatma, Vilasati Paramatma, Jagradadishvavastha, Jagradadishvavastha, Swahamahamiti Sakshat, Swahamahamiti Sakshi Rupena Buddhehe, Sakshi Rupena Buddhehe. This verse is unusually complete. If you wanted a single verse to unfold what is Atma, this verse does as well as any, and you'll see how many aspects are there. Interesting that it should take a lot of words to describe something. Remember, we used two words in our last class, swata siddha and swaprakasha. That which is swaprakasha, self-shining, and swata siddha, self-established. Self-established means more obvious than the nose on your face. So if Atma is Swaprakasha, self-shining, self-revealing, and Swata Siddha, self-established, then why should it take so many words to convey to us what Atma is? And as we said at the end of the last class, the problem is the intensity of our ignorance and wrong conclusions. Our ignorance is so deep, as it were. Our wrong conclusions are so many, for certain. Therefore, we require all these teachings. We require, as you've heard me say before, we need all the help we can get. Here we have a lot of help. Let's see this first. So Atma here is described as, and we'll just go through sequentially from top to bottom. Prakriti, vikriti, bhinnaha. Sometimes you describe Atma in terms of what it's not. We described, in fact, when we started with anatma, we described in great detail why we do so. So what is atma? Atma is bhinnaha. It is different from, it is separate from. Separate from what? Prakriti and vikriti. These two words are used here as a pair to indicate prakriti, nature in general, But in a sense, we're talking about cause and effect. Prakriti here means cause. Vikriti in this context means effect. Whatever you see around you, it's all cause and effect. The entire world can be described in terms of cause and effect. So the entire universe is described here as prakriti and vikriti, cause and effect, and atma is bhinnaha, separate, which means anything known to you as a cause or as an effect, if it's known to you, it is not atma. And that includes, as we, I think in the last class we mentioned, in deep samadhi, when you have that experience of a bright light shining through the darkness like a thousand suns. That bright light shining like a thousand suns in samadhi, is it known to you or not? It is known to you. Since it is known to you, it is not atma. Anything known to you, including that meditative experience, anything known to you is either prakriti or vikriti. It's either cause or effect. Therefore, atma is bhinnaha, different from all of that. Further, atma is described here as shuddha bodha swabhavaha. Atma is one whose swabhava, whose essential nature, is shuddha bodha. Bodha here means knowledge. Shuddha bodha, pure knowledge. Now, pure knowledge means what? Not obviously, it doesn't mean untainted knowledge. Like you could have impure knowledge is when you, I don't know, seeing some pornography. Impure knowledge. That's not the sense at all. Here, shuddha bodha, pure knowledge, means knowledge and nothing else. Now that seems a little strange. What do we mean by knowledge and something else? Usually knowledge is accompanied by an object of knowledge. For example, you know I'm sitting here. Well, not only is there knowledge of me sitting here, but there's also me sitting here. These are two factors. One is jnanam, knowledge, and the other is jnayam, the object known. So that is, as opposed to vishaya bodha, we would call that, as opposed to shuddha bodha, pure knowledge, we would call that one vishaya bodha. Vishaya bodha means knowledge of an object. Generally, knowledge is knowledge of an object. Vishaya bodha, knowledge of so many things. What would it be like if you had bodha without a vishaya? Knowledge without an object of knowledge. Knowledge without something known. To be knowing without a particular object to be known. Now that's not a very ordinary experience. In meditation, and arguably in deep sleep, even deep sleep, set that aside, there's a problem with that metaphor. In certain forms of meditation, you can achieve a condition in which you are fully conscious, fully aware, but your mind is so silent, there's nothing to be known. You can be conscious without being conscious of something. Consciousness without an object. That's what shuddha bodha means. Usually, bodha, knowledge, is vishaya bodha, knowledge of a particular object. Here, shuddha bodha. Knowledge without an object, consciousness without an object, which means just consciousness. Shuddha bodha means just consciousness. Consciousness and nothing else, no object, no, just pure consciousness, shuddha bodha. So atma is one who is shuddha bodha subhava. The nature, the subhava of atma is shuddha bodha, pure consciousness, objectless consciousness. Objectless consciousness means the presence or absence of objects means nothing. Doesn't make any difference whatsoever. Okay, enough. Sada sat iti asesham bhasayan. Vishesham Bhasayan. Bhasayan, illuminate. Consciousness illumines what? Illumines whatever is happening in your mind. Whatever is happening in your mind is Ashesham. All of that, without leaving anything out, Ashesham. All mental activities, Bhasayan, are illumined by your consciousness. Whether those activities are Sat, existent, or Asat, non-existent. Now, that may seem a little strange. Sat, Asat, Iti. Whether those mental activities are Sat, present, as they are right now in a waking state, right now, you're aware of various activities of your mind. Tonight, when you're dreaming, there are also mental activities that you're aware of. But then, in deep sleep, there are no mental activities. But we went through deep sleep in great length in the prior class. I'm not going to go through all of that again today. We did it very nicely, I think, in the last class. So in deep sleep, we established without any doubt that you are as conscious in deep sleep as you are right now. And if you don't get that, I request you please listen to the last class again. This is such a crucial and important teaching of Advaita Vedanta, to understand that you are as conscious right now, as conscious as you are right now, you are that conscious in deep sleep. What is the difference? Right now you're conscious of lots of activities happening in your mind. Manovrittis, all of these mental activities. In deep sleep, you are conscious of the absence of activities in your mind. That's what the word asat here means. So sat, in the presence of mental activities, and asat, in the absence of mental activities, consciousness, atma, bhasayan, ashesham, illumines everything in your mind. Illumines the presence of activities in the waking and dream states, illumines the absence of activities in deep sleep. And just briefly, remember that one metaphor I gave was standing. Actually, I don't know that I gave it in the last class. I've given it elsewhere. The experience of deep sleep is like entering a dark closet, pitch black closet, so black, so dark that you can't see your hand in front of your face. Imagine standing in that closet with your eyes wide open. Standing in that dark closet with your eyes wide open, do you see? Well, you haven't gone blind, right? You're not blind, therefore you see. What do you see? Nothing. Exactly. In deep sleep, you are conscious of nothing. Exactly like being in a dark closet. Okay, enough. Sadasat iti ashesham bhasayan. Consciousness. Illumining everything that happens in your mind. Ashesham means everything. Everything, whether it's sat or asat, and activities and the absence of activities in your mind, bhasayan. Illumining all of that. And that consciousness, that atma, is described as nirvishesha. Free from any attributes. Now that seems a little abstract, so let's fill that in. Suppose, consciousness, atma, is illumining the activities in your mind, a little bit like this light is illumining me sitting here. Suppose this light, instead of being a white light, a colorless light, suppose it were a red light. I would look red. Suppose it were a blue light. I would look blue. If it were green, I would look green, etc., etc. So if the light is not colorless, if the light is colored, it will impart its color to the object being seen, which means you won't see the object as it is, you'll see it colored. Well, how about this? In order to perceive mental objects as they are, the light of consciousness should necessarily be uncolored, so to speak. Notice, because white light has no particular color, it reveals exactly what is there without distortion in the same way. Consciousness is like that white light. It doesn't impart any of its characteristics, any of its qualities to the objects being seen in your mind because it is, metaphorically speaking, colorless. The term here, nirvishesha, means without any attributes, without any qualities. Qualityless is like colorless. So colorless light illumines exactly what is there in the same way. Nirvishesha Atma Chaitanya, the light of consciousness, which is free from any qualities, illumines the activities in your mind without any distortion. So that nirvishesha is actually a very important term here. Then, vilasati paramatma, jagrat adishu avasthasu. You have to pick up that next syllable. Jagrat adishu avasthasu. Avasthasu, in the states of experience, jagrat adishu, like jagrat, swapna, and sushupti, in the three states of experience, in the waking, dream, and deep sleep states, paramatma vilasati, atma shines. Vilasati, shines. Now, I said atma, this is paramatma. There is only paramatma. There is no other atma other than paramatma. This is an important point. We touched upon briefly, let's make sure that this one is clear. This whole talk, jivatma, paramatma, this atma, that atma, all of this stuff, nonsense. Just like talking about many gods, to talk of many gods is nonsense on a theological level. To talk of different kinds of atma or many atmas on a philosophical level is equally silly. And here's why. Atma is that by which your thoughts are known right now. Consciousness. Chaitanya, consciousness. Now, the question we've just touched upon is, let's return to this. We like to make distinctions between your consciousness and my consciousness. So now we have two consciousnesses. In fact, now we have, almost 100 consciousnesses. 100 consciousness? Oh my gosh, I thought there's only one. How do we reconcile these many consciousnesses versus one consciousness? And the best way, last year in great depth, in last year's class or the year before, I forget, we went through that bucket drishtanta. And I don't think we should spend a long time on it, but there's no better way of seeing the fact that there is only one consciousness. There is only paramatma. There's no other atma. So let us just see that one. This metaphor needs a picture, so we'll see a picture. So as most of you know, we have the sun shining very happily on a bunch of buckets. The buckets are full of water. You all remember all of this stuff. And I'm going to do this. This is going to be the short version. I don't think we want to do the long version of this. So, when you look inside this bucket, you see reflected on the surface of the water, you see the sun. You look in this bucket, you see reflected on the surface of the water the same sun. In every bucket you look at, you see the same sun reflected. Do you see there are four buckets. You see only one-fourth of the sun in each bucket? You see the entire globe of the sun reflected in each of these buckets. Now, it's true that if the water is jiggling a little bit differently in each of these buckets, that the image of the sun can look a little different. It'll get a little bit distorted. But it is the same light, correct? Now let's pick up the Darshtanta to make sure that you're very clear about this. What you experience is consciousness reflected by your mind. Just like the sunlight is reflected by the water in each bucket, in the same way, consciousness is reflected by the nature of your mind. If your mind is very still, that consciousness is reflected in a very pristine way. If your mind is very agitated, you can imagine the nature of the sun reflected if the water is very agitated. So, this reflected consciousness is what you experience. What you experience right now is reflected consciousness. Consciousness modified by the ripples in your mind. Ripples in your mind are called vrittis. So according to the vrittis in your mind, you have this experience. Now here's a very Vedantic question. See if you like this one. What is the content of this experience? So this is consciousness reflected in the ripples of your mind give rise to this experience. What is this experience made of? Well, when you see the sun reflected in a bucket, what is that image made of? The image is made of sunlight. Now please note, if the water is very still, the reflected sunlight is nothing but sunlight. Watch this. If there are a gazillion ripples, if the water is extremely agitated, you see a very distorted sun. But watch this. The distorted sun you see is nothing but sunlight. A distorted image of the sun is nothing but sunlight, which means no matter how complex the activities of your mind become, it's nothing but consciousness. Nothing but consciousness. Experience is nothing but consciousness. Just like all of these reflected suns are nothing but sunlight, in the same way, whatever you experience at any time, jagrat, supna, sushupti, shu, in all the three states of experience, whatever you experience is nothing but consciousness. And finally, and the obvious part now, is, and how many suns are there? Are there four suns? Are there 100 suns? You get it. How simple. One consciousness, reflected by however many minds, however many sentient beings, give rise to numerous experiences. We each have individual, distinct experience, but the content of your experience is consciousness. The content of my experience is consciousness. That consciousness is Paramatma, and there's only one. So if there's only one, we don't have to distinguish, right? There's no your consciousness, there's no my consciousness. There's no jivatma, there's no atma, this atma, that atma. So we just say one paramatma. And that's what our text says. All right. Nice expression. So paramatma velasati. That one consciousness, velasati, shines. Jagradarishu. Avastasu, in the three states of experience. How does it shine? Aham, aham, iti, sakshat. It shines sakshat, directly. Directly how? As aham, aham, aham. Aham, as you know, is a Sanskrit pronoun, I. First person, singular pronoun, I. Now, we saw this, I think, two verses ago. The I we're talking about is not the aham pratyaya. We distinguished, right? Aham pratyaya means I thought. Aham vritti or aham pratyaya means the I thought. Or ahankara, what I often translate as the sense of individuality, the feeling you have that you are an individual person having an individual experience, that feeling of individuality that we discussed in a prior class, the feeling that goes away in deep sleep and moments of absorption. That which goes away in deep sleep or a moment of absorption is aham pratyaya, the I thought or ahankara, but notice that's not what we're talking about here. Aham, aham, iti. The presence of I. I is a pronoun. Pronouns always refer to something. What does I refer to? I refers to the knower and not a known. We've done this several times, right? Anything known is not an I. The table is known, it's not I. My body is known, it's not I. Your thoughts are known, not I. Even the I thought is known. Aham pratyaya is known. You know its presence right now, you know its absence in a moment of absorption. Even the I thought is not I. Then what can I possibly refer to? What can the pronoun I refer to? What's left? You. You, the conscious being called Paramatma. In fact, it describes very nicely here. What's left? Aham, aham, iti. That which is present, sakshat, immediately, directly, that which is present as I. Sakshi rupena buddhehe. That which is present as I. Sakshi rupena, as the awareful witness, buddhehe, of the mind. Buddhehe sakshi rupena, as the awareful witness of the mind. I. Which I are we talking about? We're talking about the I that knows what's happening in your mind right now. The I that knows the experience right now. That I is what? Sakshi rupa. That I is the sakshi, awareful witness. Sakshi rupena, as the awareful witness, buddhehe, of the buddhi, of the mind, of all the mental activities. Sakshi rupena, buddhehe, as the awareful witness of all mental activities. Aham, aham, iti, sakshat. It is directly present as I. That's it. I think a thorough verse. Again, if you wanted one verse that did a fairly good job of unfolding what is Atma, I don't think you could find a better verse than this. And with this verse, we come to the end of that question about what is Atma that went on for several verses. Yeah. Okay. So, having concluded then that topic about Atma, the next of the questions we saw in that one verse, seven questions. One of those questions, after including what is Atma, what is Anatma, one of those questions was Konama Bandaha. Konama, what is that which we call Bandaha, bondage? What is bondage? And that's our next question. This question is answered just in one verse. Long verse, but one verse. So let's see that verse.
Atranatman yahamiti matir. Atranatman yahamiti matir. Bandaheshu syapum saha. Bandaheshu syapum saha. Prapto jnanat janana marana. Prapto jnana janana marana klesha sampata hetuhu klesha sampata hetuhu.
yenai vayam vapuriramasat, yenai vayam vapuriramasat, satyamityatma buddhya, satyamityatma buddhya, hushyat yukshat yavati vishayais, hushyat yukshat yavati vishayais, tantubhih kosha kridvat, tantubhih kosha kridvat. All right, that's our verse. Konama bandha, what is it that you mean by bandha? What is bondage? And kind of important, what is bondage? Because bondage, as we said right at the very beginning of this series of classes, bondage is a source of suffering. Vedanta, as we've said several times, Vedanta is not a system of philosophy. A system of philosophy is interested in truth. If you're interested in truth, go study some philosophy. Vedanta is not interested. Vedanta is not focused on an abstract pursuit of truth. Vedanta, as you've heard said here many times, Vedanta is the solution to the problem of suffering. So, now we begin to discuss what is the nature of that suffering, where does that suffering come from? Bandha, bondage. Bondage to what? Bondage to a life of suffering. Suffering in this life, suffering in the next life, and the next life, and the next life. That's what we mean by bandha, bondage. All right, what about that bondage? Atra, here, in this matter, anatmani aham iti matihi bandha esha asya pumsaha. Asya pumsaha, for a person, asya pumsaha, for this person, for a person, eshaha bandha, this is bondage. What is bondage? It is anatmani aham iti matihi. Aham iti matihi. Mati here means conclusion. A conclusion, aham iti, a conclusion that this is I, aham iti. Aham iti matihi, the conclusion that this is I, but to have that conclusion, anatmani, we have to separate the words. To have the conclusion, this is I, to have that conclusion with regard to something which is not I, anatmani. Anatmani, with regard to anatma, to conclude this is I, how silly would it be if I said, I am a table. Table is anatma. If I have aham mati, if I have the conclusion of I-ness with reference to this table, you think I need to see a doctor, right? Exactly. But watch this. The table is an object known to me. If I say I know this table, therefore I am a table, silly. But this body is an object known to me, just like the table is an object known to me. If I say I am this body, you don't think I'm so crazy. But, in fact, I would say you're crazy. Because, as far as I'm concerned, this body is every bit as much an object as a table. I don't see any difference at all. This is an object, this is an object. To have aham iti matihi, to have a conclusion of I-ness in anatma, in an object known to you. This is eshaha bandha. This is bondage. Now, how can that wrong, it says that aham mati is actually a wrong conclusion, right? To have aham mati with regard to anatma is a wrong conclusion. Why should this wrong conclusion be called bondage? Because look at the consequence of this wrong conclusion. If I say I am this table, and it's an old table, then I am old. If it's a broken table, I am broken. Hey, stupidity. It's an old body. I am old. It's a broken body. I am broken. You get this. And we've talked about this several times. I don't think we need to go any further. Whatever you identify with becomes a source of suffering. You identify with a table, the table becomes a source of suffering. You identify with the body is a source of suffering. Remember the example I gave was identifying with your car. If you're identified with your car gets a little dent, and it's like you got dented. You're so upset your car got a little dent. It's a car. So it has a dent. It's a body. So it's old. So it's ill. Whatever. What can we do for that? Cars get dents. Bodies get old and ill. In American English, nice way. The expression is not deal with it, it's simply deal. Hey, deal. Vedantically, it means come on, grow up, understand the reality. Tables get old and broken, bodies get old and broken. We had better be able to handle that, but you can't handle it if it's me. This is the source of suffering. Eshaha bandaha. This bondage is rooted in aham matihi, in this conclusion of I-ness, anatmani, in that which is not I. So, that is bondage. And praptaha. Bandha praptaha. And how did this bondage come about, or what is the cause of this bondage? Bandha praptaha ajnanat, obviously, due to ignorance. This bandha, this bondage, which is connected to this conclusion of I-ness in what is not I, this is praptaha ajnanat. This exists. It this obtains due to ignorance. And not just any ignorance, but specifically, if I fail to know my true nature, it's inevitable that I will take the body, mind, and senses as being me. Failure to recognize one's true nature, as my guru says, self-non-recognition. Self-non-recognition is a fancy English way of saying ajnana, ignorance. Ignorance of your true self. And just to see this in perspective, notice every child, do you think children are born knowing I am Satchidananda Atma? Certainly not. Children are born ignorant. We're all born in ignorance. So therefore, isn't it only natural for each and every one of us as children to identify with our bodies, minds, senses, etc.? Of course, in the absence of self-knowledge, how could we not identify with body, mind, and senses? But now, as adults, we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to address this particular ignorance. Ignorance of your true nature, as Satchidananda Atma, as Paramatma. Suppose you get this knowledge. With this particular knowledge that you are Satchidananda Atma, if you really get it, how can you be the body? If you really get it, it becomes as obvious as the table that the body is not I. We talked about this briefly in the last class. There is absolutely no necessity to go on repeating in your mind, I am not this body, I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm not this mind. Where is the necessity of repeating that? It's like, You have to go on repeating throughout the day, I'm a human being, I'm a human being, I'm a human being. Because if you stop repeating it, you might be something else. You know you're a human being, so therefore what's the point of repeating that? If you know you're Satchitananda Atma, then why do you have to tell yourself you're not the body? You don't. If you know you're Satchitananda. And if you don't know you're Satchitananda Atma, and you go on repeating, I am not this body, I'm not this body, you're very confused. Because if you don't know you're Satchitananda Atma, then you think I am this body, and then you go on saying, I'm not this body, I'm not... How? No wonder people get so confused when they study Vedanta. That's not how Vedanta works. Vedanta doesn't work through repeating a formula like I'm not the body. Vedanta works by removing ignorance. There is ignorance with regard to your true nature as Satchitananda Atma. Vedanta removes that ignorance. So here, konama bandha, what is this bondage? This bondage is aham matihi anatmani. It's having the conclusion of I-ness in what is not I, and that is ajnanat, due to ignorance, due to self non-recognition. And that bondage then is janana marana klesha sampata hetuhu. One word, compound word. The way we get the meaning of these compound words usually is right to left. So this bondage, bandha, is the hetu, is the cause. Is the cause for what? Sampata. Sampata means falling. Falling into what? Klesha, misery. Falling into what kind of misery? Janana, marana. Getting born, dying. Getting born, dying. Actually, what's in between is the misery. When you're born, you know, at the moment of birth, there's no misery. At the moment, after the moment of death, there's no misery. Misery is what comes in between. So, janana, marana, klesha. That misery, that suffering. So, this bondage is the sampata hetu. It's the cause for falling, sampata, falling into this klesha, this misery of getting born and dying. And the verse continues. Yena, eva, yena, because of which, because of this bondage, yena, because of this bondage, eva, indeed, because of this bondage alone, better, because of this bondage alone, I am this one, this person, this individual person, this one, a person, idam vapuhu, idam asat vapuhu, idam, this, asat, unreal vapuhu, body. This idam, this vapu, this body, which is asat in our Vedantic definition. The Vedantic definition of sat is that which is unborn, uncreated, unchanging. Our bodies are born. Our bodies are constantly changing. So in that context. So idam, idam, this, asat, changing, vapuhu, this changing body. What about this changing body? Satyam iti. Atma buddhya. Atma buddhya. With the buddhi, with the conclusion that this is atma. We're right back to that aham mati. Back to that same theme here. Atma buddhya. With the attitude that this body is atma. This body is me. Satyam iti. This body is satyam. Satyam means that which is unborn, uncreated, unchanging, real in that sense. To conclude that this body is the true me, the eternal me. Oh my gosh. With that conclusion, you can't even sleep comfortably at night because you know your body is the most, I don't want to sound too grim, but let's admit it, our bodies are not terribly reliable. And it's only going to get worse. So if you have what the American expression, all your eggs in that basket, you're in big trouble. And that's what it says here. Atma buddhya, looking upon idam asatvapuhu, looking at this transient body, satyamiti, looking upon it as real, looking upon it as atma buddhya, looking upon it as the real me. Absolutely in trouble. But what is the consequence of taking the body? And we could extend it to the mind and senses if we want. What is the consequence of taking the body, mind, and senses as me? Well, pushyati, ukshati, avati, vishayaihi. There's a little poetry here. So, I am, you have to make the connection here. I am a person, idam asadvapuhu, this body. What about this body? I am pushyati. A person will nourish this body. Vishayaihi, with various objects. What are the objects? Well, food, drink, etc. So I am a person, pushyati, nourishes idam asatvapuhu, this transient body. You nourish it with lots of vishayas, objects, things that you eat and drink, etc. Now, you might think there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a problem. The problem is one of the attitude. I bet some of you have houseplants, and what do you do with that houseplant? You push your tea. You nourish that houseplant. You give it water, and you give it fertilizer. You make sure it gets some sunlight. Sooner or later, it dies. No matter what, you nurture it and it dies. No matter how much pushyati, no matter how much we nurture this one, it's going to die. Ukshati. We also, ukshati, actually in Vedic language, they use the term anoint. We anoint this one. And it's kind of like, you know, the in a more classical culture, you know, to anoint with sandal paste, etc. Other kinds of, any kind of anointing, any liquid, to take a shower. Good. So we're taking care of this one. We feed this one. We shower this one. It's still going to die. No matter how much we take care of it, avati, we protect this one. No matter how much we nurture this one, pushyati, no matter how much we ukshati, wash it, shampoo it, whatever it is, no matter how much we avati, no matter how much we try to protect this one, it's still going to die. And tell me, isn't your commitment to nurturing this one, to washing this one, to protecting this one, doesn't that lead to a problem, the problem of identification? So years ago, I told this funny story. When I was a young man, I moved to California. I grew up in the Midwest, moved to California in the 1970s, and I saw something in suburban California that I hadn't seen before. I noticed that on Saturday mornings in suburban California, everyone was out in their driveway. Their car was out in the driveway. Everyone is washing their cars. This is a Saturday morning ritual in Southern California, at least in the 1970s, to go out and wash your car. Southern California is car culture, at least in those days. I don't know what it's like today. It's a car culture. And the reason is Los Angeles is so spread out, the only way you can ever get around, mass transit is useless, you need a car. It's a car culture. So people become very fond of their cars, so much so that on Saturday mornings are lovingly massaging their cars with shampoo. Now look at this. So they lovingly massage their cars with shampoo. It's still going to break down. And worse, it can get stolen. Now, suppose you weren't so concerned about that car. You know, instead of lovingly washing this car and all of that, I'll tell you a true story. This is 1977, if I remember right. I got my college degree. I drove to California in a 20-year-old Dodge Dart. It was rusting and falling apart, and it was a piece of junk. It's what I could afford in college. And I knew it was, I didn't care about it, it was a piece of junk. And one day, I got a call from the police, 4 o'clock in the morning. I got a call from the police. Your car is parked in front of somebody's garage. I didn't leave the car there. He says, oh, your car's probably been stolen. Who cares? I could care. He said, no, you have to come and get it. It's in the way. I honestly could care less. That car was such a pile of junk, and I finally got a job. I could finally afford a proper car. But notice the difference. Somebody who has a car, it's a pile of junk. If it's stolen, you don't care. But the fellow out massaging his car on Saturday morning, if that car is stolen. Now, look at the connection here. What do we do with these? These are our vehicles. That was a 1965 Dodge Dart. This is a 1953 American model. How's that? So for all these years, push your tea, feed it a lot of food, ukshati, wash it, massage it, shampoo it, and avati, protect it. It's still going to die. This is the attitude that's being pointed out here. This attachment to the body, that's what's indicated by these three verbs, pushyati, ukshati, and avati. You nurture it, you wash it, you protect it, means you're attached to it. You're attached to it and it's going to die. It's an object of bondage. The body causes bondage by your attachment to it. Again, if you weren't attached to it, then it could go and you'd be fine. Like my old car could be stolen and I didn't care. If you're not attached to the body, let it go. When the time comes, let it go. But that's not what happens. For most people, due to attachment, the body is a source of bondage. And that source of bondage is described here with this wonderful metaphor. Tantubihi koshakritvat. Koshakrit is the name of an insect. In fact, you can make out the name. Kosha means covering. Koshakrit is the name of an insect that makes a covering, like a silkworm. And that's exactly what a koshakrit is. A koshakrit is a silkworm. Notice that the silkworm puts the silk around itself, effectively trapping itself within the kosha of its own making. Tantubihi, with its threads, tantubihi means with threads, tantubihi koshakrit, so that silkworm spins its threads around itself, trapping itself, and I know that it serves a purpose. That's not the metaphor. The metaphor, of course, is I think it turns into a different crit. Does it undergo this metamorphosis, I suppose, and emerges from it. Like, I'm guessing it's like a caterpillar, but I just don't know the life cycle of silkworms. I don't know, but we don't care. The metaphor is not that. The metaphor is simply that this silkworm becomes entrapped by its own kosha, its own covering that it spins. Who spins the web of life in which we find ourselves trapped? We do a good job of it. You know, people in some texts, they use this term Maya Jala, the web of Maya. To me, that term is too abstract, because it means that some Maya created this Jala, some Maya created this web. No, you created this web. We trap ourselves in a web of complexity, a web of attachment, a web of worldly life, which leads to suffering, just like that silkworm, and that is bandha. So this verse we just concluded describes bandha. Ko nama bandha? The question came, what is bondage? So it said, bondage is the wrong conclusion that the body, etc., is I, and then due to attachment to the body, etc., due to that attachment, the body becomes a source of bondage, just like that silkworm trapped inside its own covering. All right, konama bandha. And that's the end of that question. The next question is katam esha agataha. I don't know that we'll finish it, so we'll start this anyway today. Katam esha agataha. Esha, this bondage. Katam agataha. How did it come? How did bondage come? We know how the silkworm got stuck in its cocoon. How did this bondage come? Let's see.
Akanda nitya dvaya bodha shaktya. Akanda nitya dvaya bodha. Spurantam atmanam ananta vaibhavam. Purantam atmanam ananta bhai samavrano tyavrati shaktiresha samavrano tyavrata shaktiresha tamo mai rahuri varka bimbam tamo mai rahuri varka bimbam samavrano ti avrati shakti hi esha.
Samavrinoti, to connect to the prior verse. Samavrinoti, it covers. So in the previous verse, we saw the silkworm was covered by its cocoon. Samavrinoti. Here there's a different kind of covering. Samavrinoti means it covers. What is being covered? Let's see what is being covered here. What is being covered?
Spurantam atmanam anantavaibhavam atmanam. Samavranoti.
Atma is covered. That Atma which is spurantam, which is shining, that Atma which is ananta vaibhavam, of infinite power, of vastness, all pervasive. This word can have many meanings. Ananta vaibhavam, this most amazing, all pervasive Atma, which is spurantam, which is shining, which is akanda nitya advaya bodha shaktya, which is endowed with bodha shakti. Bodha shakti, the power of awareness, which is advaya. We're not going to go through this. This verse will take quite a while to get to the whole meaning. Let's just phrase a leading question. Let's end the class with a question, we'll end the class with a question with which we'll begin the next class when we see this verse. This Atma we're talking about is Swaprakasha. It's shining. Right now, you're conscious. It is Swatasiddha. No one needs to tell you you're conscious. If I ask you if you're conscious, you don't have to turn, if your spouse is sitting here, you don't have to ask, am I conscious? You don't need to ask anyone. You know you're conscious. How can that self-evident, self-shining consciousness, how can it be unknown? And what we'll see in the next class is this verse really builds up the Atma as something great, mighty, powerful. If it's so great, mighty, and powerful, and it's already you, how can it possibly be unknown? If Atma is Ananta Vaibhavam, if it's possessed of infinite capacity, how can that one be covered? Avranoti. How can that which is all pervasive be covered? How large would the cover need to be? You see the problem? So here we're going to get into a very profound discussion about the nature of ignorance. How is it that ignorance is capable of covering? Again, look at that image. If Atma is all pervasive, how large does the cover need to be? Right? But that's the problem that we need to address. How can ignorance cover avranoti? How can ignorance cover that Atma, which is all pervasive? So I think we'll set that verse aside. We'll see that in the next class, and then we'll discuss katam eshaha agataha. How did this bondage come about? There are several verses on that one. We'll continue in our next class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.